thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 4 for April 18th, 2007. Welcome to The Social. I'm Dan Cohen, this week's host. Well, welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. We are here once again with the regulars. I'm Dan Cohen, as you just heard in the introduction, and can be found at dancohen.org. And we also have with us today Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan. How are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. A little cold, but pretty well.
Yeah, we have a vicious April storm outside. And we also have with us Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys.
How's it going?
It's all right. Good.
Well, we have a lot to discuss today, so I'm going to jump right in and actually just lead off with a little bit of what happened last week, and Tom's going to talk a little bit about what he's experienced in terms of two different conferences. So there's been a lot going on with things digital and academic and museum related. And I went to the meeting at the National Endowment for the Humanities, which brought together the Digital Humanities Centers. So these are centers like the Center for History and New Media at George Mason, where we work, centers at UVA, UCLA, USC, Brown, UIUC, and other places. I think there were about 17 centers that came together. It wasn't a comprehensive list of groups, and I think there'll be a larger meeting later on that brings together even more people who are working on the digital humanities, particularly those in centers like our own. But it was really nice to see everyone come together. I think it's the first time, really, that I've seen a lot of these different groups work together and come together to discuss challenges that we all face and you know, what we do, and talk to each other about specifically the ways that we go about doing our projects. So it was a really interesting meeting, and I just wanted to raise a few things with the panel today. First of all, I think it was a really interesting introduction from Bruce Cole, who's the chairman of the NEH, and he was talking about how technically illiterate he was actually when he began his tenure as the chairman of the NEH, and that really during his tenure he's just seen this tremendous surge in interest in digital tools, digital collections. He mentioned that they've just digitized 30 million pages of historical newspapers, and talked really about how there's this sort of whole new era of digital technology that's going to have a profound impact on the humanities. And so I think the first thing to say is just that this is really now, I think, on the map. And I think Tom and Mills, you're probably aware of this, is, you know, we've known each other for many years, and you can see really the difference between, say, 5 years ago in 2002 and where we are now in terms of just visibility of this. And part of the visibility was that, in fact, the vice president of and chief internet evangelist from Google was there, Vint Cerf. And actually, Dan Clancy, who's the head of the technical head of the Google book scanning project or Google book search project, was there as well. So it really shows you really where things are and sort of the bringing together of kind of commercial and nonprofit and academic interests. And I think Vint gave a pretty interesting talk where he sort of reminded people that everything of value is not found through a Google search, which everyone giggled about. Of course, they're trying to change that by digitizing everything that they can get their hands on. And he actually came to sort of talk about a thousand-year view, which I thought was pretty interesting. I mean, I don't really see, for instance, how the Google scans, which are not really that high quality, are going to really last for a thousand years. So I'm not quite sure where he was going with that. And actually, after his talk, he received a little bit of flack from certain parties in the audience who were saying that, you know, Google has its own best interests at heart and not those of libraries or or universities. Anyway, and of course, Vint Cerf responded very comically to that by telling those people that he'd meet them in the alley with a pistol after the meeting.
I think to any historian is going to see a sort of 1,000-year view as kind of problematic. I mean, it's very difficult to see what's going to happen in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years, never mind 1,000. But it is good, I think, that they're at least talking that way and thinking that way. Whether they're actually making any progress in that direction, that's another question. But it sounds good.
Right. You know, Vint was saying, well, it might be that we have to convert everything to 8-bit ASCII, which is, you know, a very basic plain text, and sort of lose all these books that have artwork or layouts with them to ensure their longevity. And I think he brought a real insider's perspective on just the technological challenges of scanning entire libraries. You know, he was talking about, for instance, images and how they've already encountered problems just with JPEGs, which, you know, it's probably the single most popular image type. And yet there's actually been a lot of different implementations of JPEG, and some of them are already unviewable. And so you really start worrying about, you know, how you scan things, what the page images are in. And, you know, it was a real sort of reality check, even for a big corporation like Google.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, the really, I think, exciting part about that movie was you can edit that out. For me, the really exciting part about that meeting was that it brought together not only people like us working in these various centers at the various universities around the country, but also some really important institutional players, people with real money to spend on this. And I think that's what's really going to make the difference over the next few years, is the recognition that doing significant work in digital humanities requires money.
That's right. I should have mentioned that right off the start, that it wasn't just the people from the digital humanities centers, but there were, excuse me, I think there were at least a dozen funders there, including government agencies as well as private foundations. And, you know, they talked about some of their challenges as well. And these are challenges that we've encountered too. And I thought John Unsworth gave a very good plenary address where he discussed how important it is to talk about failure, which is not something that we normally like to talk about, but happens all the time with digital projects. I mean, so many things have to go right for a digital project like a software or a major website to really be completed, to work as advertised, that I think the funders are a little gun-shy about funding them. And they worry about sustainability and longevity, and the centers worry about you know, attracting and retaining talented technical staff. So, you know, this is very difficult. And I think John had a really good suggestion, which was, you know, reporting about failures could actually be a big help for all of us, simply because it'll sort of tell you things that have gone wrong and give a sort of clue to new people working in the digital humanities, all the things that they kind of have to worry about, and, you know, to ensure that their project goes right. And that even in failures, there are, you know, important things to learn about methodology and technologies and management of these projects. And so I thought that was a really great point that he made.
Yeah, I think it points to the fact that, you know, and I think that the assemblage of institutions that were at that meeting point to the fact that we really haven't figured this thing out yet. You know, I think there are lots of different models for doing digital humanities work. And even institutionally, they function very, very differently. You know, our shop here at George Mason is very different from another very successful shop, you know, just down the road at UVA, and just in the way it's funded, in the way it's organized, in the kinds of people working here, the kinds of interests we have, and so there's a lot of room for failure. There's a lot of room for success, and I think as the discipline grows and professionalizes, we're going to figure a lot of these things out.
Yeah, and I think the overall conclusion of the meeting was that, you know, the important thing about these centers is that they do have a kind of expertise that's been cultivated over the years that I think other faculty and students and others in the humanities can really benefit from, and they're not benefiting from right now. So there was a lot of discussion about, internships, of faculty fellowships, of faculty members that might be at, let's say, a small liberal arts college that doesn't have a digital humanities center, could spend a semester or a year at one of these centers to really learn the ropes and then sort of bring back the skills that they learned to that institution. So using them as a, you know, as John called it, they are part of the cyber infrastructure, what we discussed last week. And he saw them as a kind of critical human infrastructure to I think, this whole practice, which is so new that we couldn't even define what it was. And I think there was a lot of discussion there as well. The funders were, a couple of the funders came back to the main session after we had breakout groups and said, well, we're actually confused as to what a digital humanities center is. You know, is it just something focused on digital techniques or computational methods or a specific discipline? Can it be a virtual organization? So I think there were a lot of great questions that were raised. And actually, at the end of the podcast today, I'll mention a site that we're setting up as an outcome of this meeting where people interested in the digital humanities can come and contribute to fleshing out a wiki that discusses those people working in the digital humanities, where it's being done, tools, standards, all the things that I think people want to learn about if they're new to the field.
You know, it's interesting. I think that there's, and here I'll maybe segue into our discussion, short discussion about museums and the web. You know, there doesn't seem to be a kind of professional locus for digital humanities in the university community in the way that there is for instance, museums. You know, the museums and the web is, there's a couple of different conferences that people go to in the museum world. But museums and the web, if you're doing technology in museums, like, that's where you go. And everybody goes. It's incredibly expensive, so I've never been. But it doesn't seem like for digital humanities in the university that there's that kind of single locus for discussion. And it seems like that's what the NEH was trying to do with this meeting, that it seems like there should be more of a one conference, the way there is, like, you know, the AHA conference or the MLA conference.
Right. Well, there is this digital humanities meeting every year, and it's at UIUC this year and in Illinois. And you know, I think what's interesting is that of all of us at the Center for History and New Media, I don't think one of us has gone to this. And I sort of feel bad about it, but I think it's because it is a little bit off the radar. And indeed, I didn't know that there was something called ADHO, which is the Alliance of Digital Humanities Organizations, which John Unsworth and others are working to build. And I think there needs to be some publicity. I think, you know, more activity in this area of bringing together people either under that umbrella or under some other umbrella.
Yeah, it seems like there's a few places where these conversations occur, but it doesn't seem like there's one that has all the buzz that attracts all the different people, both right. from the kind of inside crew, the few centers that were invited to the NEH meeting, but also from, you know, that attracts membership and interest from individual scholars working at smaller institutions that don't have digital humanities center. It just doesn't seem like there is a real professional locus for this work yet. And I think that's going to be an important part.
So, Tom, at the museums meeting, what structures are in place, technological or organizationally, that help with this kind of networking and kind of working together online on these topics of common interest?
Yeah, there's sort of two things I've noticed in the past like year or so that have cropped up in the museum community that help help with this community building. And the first is there's a group of it's a contractor, a vendor of design services for museums, has set up a museum blogs site, which is an aggregator of all the museum blogs that are out there on the web. And, you know, there's hundreds at this point, but it's a good place, a good single place to go to look for people thinking about technology in museums. The other thing is that this Museums and the Web conference, which has been going on for several years now, they've just started, it seems, this year, and as I said, I wasn't able to go, but they started a social networking portal for people at the conference. And it had facilities for people to engage in discussion forums, to aggregate people blogs that were of people who were blogging the conference live. It had polls. It had a place to share references for articles that were cited and papers that were being given. It had a section that said, you know, who's online now, so you could engage in live chats with people at the conference. It just seemed like people had put a lot more thought into how to organize a conference with the tools that, you know, digital museums people would want to use, and to put those tools into place to make the conference hold together a little better. I know from some of the blogs I've read, though, that the one problem, and this is really a problem at all these kinds of big conferences, is that they had horrible web connectivity in the ballroom in which it was right. being held. And, you know, these hotels charge outrageous amounts of money for really crummy web connectivity. And I think they had that problem. But at least the structures were in place to make this work. And I think we would really benefit in the university community from a similar kind of conference with that kind of thought put into how to share and exchange information.
Yeah, I think the crowd at my meeting at the NEH, it wasn't a big blogger crowd. And obviously it was a sort of limited crowd as a first meeting. But I think I was only one of maybe three or four people there with, you know, who were actually writing notes down for a blog post, which I'm going to get to this week and post some more detailed notes. So unlike, let's say, the museum or library community, where there's lots of people blogging and the very active discussions that happen almost in real time via, you know, blogs and other methods. I don't think it was really that kind of a crowd. I think a little bit more on the kind of managerial level. But I think that those structures sound really great, and I think could have contributed quite a bit to the meeting. We did begin to set up a couple of wikis, and I'll mention one of those later on. Let's see, are there other news items from this week? We heard that the Creative Commons initiative is creating a new unit called CC Learn, and it seems like it has a lot of potential. I think one of the first issues that they're tackling, other than just staffing it, they have an opening for an executive director, but they're trying to put together actually a license for higher education that you can use, just a single Creative Commons license for teaching materials and educational materials, and I think that's just a great idea. I think we've wondered which one of the many different Creative Commons licenses to use on different projects here at the center. It would be terrific to have one for higher ed to sort of free up all of this, all of these things like syllabi and teaching materials that could be put on the web.
Is that going to apply to student materials? I know, like last week or the week before, we talked about the problems of copyright of student materials. Would students be able to release their stuff under this license?
I think it's an opt-in kind of a license where any course materials that you want, and I suppose, sure, it could be student papers or blogs or anything like that, could be put up under the CC Learn license. I do think it has to be educationally related, and so I'm not quite sure where it fits in with their existing licenses. But it's clear that they're trying to, I think, enable a little bit more in terms of open education, and probably work with, I assume, OpenCourseWare and other projects that are trying to sort of expose internal university materials to a wider audience, and I think get away from some of the silos of stuff that are behind gates at universities.
Which will certainly be a great change if we can pull it off, because so much good material is stuck behind those passwords, and not necessarily because faculty members choose to put it behind the password, but because that's the default setting at the university.
Right, and so I suppose this would be something that could be adopted university-wide. You could say, whatever our Moodle installation is going to use the CC Learn license, and then it would, be a blanket kind of license for anything that would go up on that installation. I suppose that's the use case for it. Also this week, we saw the launch of Google My Maps, and we've been doing a lot of these Google Maps mashups, and we've discussed it, I believe, on an earlier podcast. But I think what's exciting here is, for those who haven't seen it yet, it's become suddenly much easier for people, and in our case, students and faculty and staff at universities or museums and libraries, to sort of place little indicators of different items onto a Google Map. And I think that really presents, up to this point, you had to have a little bit more technical sophistication or knowledge to actually do these kinds of map mashups, but I think with the launch of My Maps, I think we're going to see a lot more sort of bubbling up from below. I certainly plan to use it in my Western Civ class because it just makes it much easier for students to put things onto a map and to collaborate on a map and so forth.
Yeah, I actually, after I read about this coming online, I sat down at the computer and did a map of all the places I've lived in the last 10 years, and which are, there are a lot of place marks, and it took me 20 minutes to do. It was very simple.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty interesting to me. I was actually a little disappointed with the announcement. I mean, I first saw the post on the O'Reilly radar, and you know, it said it billed it as, you know, it adds the ability to create and share maps directly from Google's site. And I was thinking of something kind of, and maybe this is just because I've come to expect way too much from technology because there's just been so much cool stuff happening lately. But I was thinking I'd be able to like create my own maps, like actually create my own maps. And really what it is you can kind of share your annotations
right.
of Google's maps. So
yeah,
I don't know.
It's a pushpin sharer, I guess.
Yeah.
But
which makes it sound a little less interesting. But
right.
I do think that the uses, you know, you were talking about, Dan and Mills, I think there are a lot of real uses for it.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it develops and whether people collaborate on maps together and to see, you know, how it looks in the classroom, you know, whether it's simple enough that students, you know, no longer have to use the API or... if they want to use Google Earth, write a KML file and these sorts of things. I think anything that sort of makes it easier for us to experiment with this is great. But I agree that, you know, if they could really release something where we could overlay a 19th century map on the current maps that they have, boy, that would be terrific. Because
right,
now
and that's kind of what I was expecting.
Yeah, you have to do a lot of manipulation and stretching and all this stuff. So I think for historians, yes, that would be a terrific next step. But you know, I think this is a good first step. And, you know, of course, it at the same time puts out of business a lot of these smaller startups that were doing the same thing. But whatever, I think it's a great start for people who want to start using maps in the classroom. This week we wanted to focus on the use and perhaps the abuse of social networking in the humanities. And as I like to often joke, professors often have their own or see an axis of evil of their own, which is, of course, MySpace, Facebook, and Wikipedia. And I think that, you know, initially, we were a little bit scared of MySpace and Facebook as well. They seem like drains of time and places just where students, you know, networked with themselves, but not us. And so I think it's taken a little while for us to sort of think about the ways in which you can integrate social networking and social networking sites like Facebook into the classroom. And our thoughts about this were sort of peaked a little bit this week with a couple of things that happened. First of all, University of Michigan launched a master's degree in social computing. So there's actually, the first in the country degree where you can actually study the use of social networking in their Library and Information Sciences school. But interesting nonetheless, interesting that Michigan, which is, I think, a good bellwether for the use of technology in the humanities and libraries and museums, has actually gone to this point of actually creating a sort of specialized degree in the use of these tools. And then from more technological side, at the Center for History and New Media, we're always keeping track of what's going on with Firefox development because of our Zotero project. And just in general, we all use Firefox pretty regularly. And they had an alpha launch of Firefox Co-op, which sort of integrates social networking technologies right into their browser. And I believe this will eventually come out in version 3.0 of the Firefox browser. And reminded us quite a bit of Flock, which is a Firefox-based alternative browser. So Flock, for instance, integrates the ability to very quickly blog on a site that you found, to connect with other people who are online, all this done right through the browser. So Flock's really been a kind of early adopter browser for a lot of people. And Firefox is now moving strongly ahead with, I think, implementing a lot of these features. Now, I have to admit, great deal of ignorance on this front, considering I do not have a MySpace page or a Facebook page. And so I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues here, Tom and Mills. You actually have these pages and actually use them.
Yeah, I've been on Facebook now for about a year and a half. I did it originally. I set up my Facebook page originally because one of our former graduate students was telling me a nightmare story about someone they had been planning to hire in her company, and then they saw the person's photographs, personal photographs, in her Facebook page, and after they saw those photographs, there was no way they were hiring that person. And so and subsequently had a conversation with our dean of students about it. So I thought I would just set up a Facebook page in part to show students that grown-ups also can have Facebook accounts and see what's going on there. And so I set up the page and then invited all the students in my Western Civ class that semester to add me as a friend. And I came into class the next day and they were all freaked out, like, how did you get a Facebook account? And I said, well, I have a .edu email address and that's all that's required. Yeah, but you're a professor. And so we had a conversation about making sure that they were a little more discreet with some of the things that they were doing. So that's how I got started. But then I noticed that my students started immediately sending me messages. And that rather than email, I was getting a bounce to my email account that I had a new message in Facebook. So I have now tell my students that there are multiple ways to get in touch with me, and one of them is email, another is they could actually come to my office hours, they could send me a message through Facebook. There's just a variety of ways. But where I really saw the big change or the big sort of utility for me was when I led a study tour in Europe in January, and I had 37 students kind of spread all around various cities in Europe at any particular moment, and they were going into internet cafes and logging into Facebook and posting messages to the group that we had created about some museum they had just been in and that everybody else needed to go check this out right away before we moved on to the next city. And I found that they were, many of them are getting, I guess, notifications in their telephone that they've gotten an email from their Facebook account, and so then they would check it out on their phone, and then they would go and show up at the museum. So it's the way that they were getting in touch with each other. And so to be part of that communications loop was really advantageous for me, but also made it very easy for me to get a message to all of them. I mean, I could have sent a group email out, but I found that they respond to Facebook messages a lot faster than they respond to email messages.
Huh.
Yeah, Tom, I found the same thing.
Have you used it, Tom?
Yeah, I have. Some of the same experiences as Mills's have. I don't think I've used it quite as extensively, but I have found that students respond to their Facebook, generally to their Facebook messages, much more quickly than email. I get the sense that email is something that they use with grown-ups, and Facebook is something that they use with their peers. And so being in that space, I think, really helps tie you more closely to the rest of their lives, which I think is, you know, always a good thing for education. Another thing I've noticed is Facebook has the ability to, it can pull a feed of your blog. And I've noticed that, you know, students who would never ever read my blog or go to the website, because on my Facebook page there is a feed of my blog, I've had a couple of students come up to me and say, oh, I read your blog post the other day, and maybe they were just trying to score brownie points or something, but it worked. You know, and they actually, you know, like took a look at what I was writing in sort of the rest of my professional life. And so I do think this is sort of where the students live. And I think if we're gonna be all that we can be as educators, I think we need to be where they are.
The two of you found any disadvantages? It sounds to me like what you're both saying is this is the kind of locus or the aggregation of everything that's going on in their life. It's where they say where they are, what they're doing, kind of post reviews and news, things like that, which I understand. And actually, I sort of fear how this is increasingly becoming real time with the launch of Twitter this new technology that allows you to very specifically say what you're doing in any moment of the day. But it's sort of the aggregation of attention into these places, that it's a sort of central place for them, even if they have, let's say, a blog or something else.
I think that it is. I think because they have so many different kinds of input, whether it's coming from their phone or from their email or from their IM account or wherever it is, at some point they have to have some kind of a nexus one place to go to focus on and have all their other communications sort of funnel in that way. Otherwise, they have to check 14 different devices during the course of the day to find out what their friends are up to. So I think it does, whether it's Facebook or whatever site, I think it does provide that kind of easy shorthand or easy system for keeping track of all their various kinds of communications.
And I actually think that's where the Firefox co-op is important. That's because it's in the aggregation of attention. Because in fact, you know, MySpace, which was all the talk of the press when Rupert Murdoch bought it, and was the place to be for kids. MySpace isn't that cool anymore. Kids have moved off MySpace and have moved on to Facebook. And in fact, Facebook isn't that cool anymore. And I suspect it's in part because people like Mills and I are there now. Facebook's not that cool anymore. And more young people are moving to new services like, I know one of the hot new ones is called Verb.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
These services are actually kind of trendy, and
isn't that a problem though? I mean, you know, as these populations sort of migrate from one thing to the next, and also lose their stuff. I mean, this is part of the problem with, you know, I'm one of these old fogies that likes email, but email is my life, and I can go back and search it and find important information and kind of remember where I was. And a lot of these other services, they're so ephemeral, both in, you know, your use of it. You know, you might use it for a year or two and then it becomes passe and you move on to something else. But also the way the messages are stored and sent, et cetera, it just seems like it just goes away and you don't have no record of where you've been or what you've said.
Well, I think that's where, like, and that's where Firefox Co-op, I haven't tried it out yet, so I'm not exactly sure how it works. But if it's using the MySQLite, the SQLite backend of Firefox to retain some of this information, and so basically what Firefox Co-op will allow you to do is it will provide a sidebar with your friends from Twitter, your friends from Facebook, your friends from Verb, your friends from MySpace, all of their profiles, and will aggregate all that material in the sidebar of your browser. So you won't have to go to each one of these sites. If it then saves that information, it could solve that problem. I'm not sure if that's what it'll do, but that would be a nice use of the SQLite backend.
Yeah, I mean, although I worry about, you know, formats and things like that. I mean, email's a known quantity. We've had it for, you know, decades, literally. And, you know, I've got a lot of stuff. I mean, we instant message a lot here at the center. And sometimes, I fail to save really important instant messages where, you know, actually decisions have been made or we really discuss some topic. And those conversations are sort of gone. And even the ones I have, you know, I have no idea what the actual IM format is and how to search it well and things like that. So,
I mean, maybe these things are just, young person's toys for that reason. You know, there are some adult social networking services out there like LinkedIn, and none of them have really ever kind of caught on. And I think it's because, it's probably because they just seem fleeting.
Yeah. Right. Well, I also wonder about, you know, I think that is a good point about, I'm not sure it's even generational. You know, I wonder about these digital natives when they're 35 or 40 or 45 and, you know, having professional careers where, you know, you can't be online all the time and, you know, you may have kids or other things going on in life that it's hard to have that full attention that I think a lot of these services require.
Well, did you see that one guy who got fired from Goldman Sachs because he was on his Facebook account like, you know, like 40 hours a week? He was working.
Right, but he was
working like
that.
2 hours a week, and he was just spending all his time on Facebook instead of working at this, you know, very well paid job.
Right. Right. Well, I think, and that's why I was bringing up at the very beginning of sort of this idea of Facebook being part of the axis of evil. I think it's, you know, it's that time sink aspect to it of requiring that intense participation and the peer pressure of it as well, right? I mean, you're connected up in a way that you aren't, let's say, with a blog. You know, you can post irregularly or what have you, but people feel like almost a physical presence when they're really tied into these networks. And you know, I get LinkedIn messages like, add me to your you know, friends list on LinkedIn, and I never respond to them because I'm just not going to get involved with it. I don't have the time to deal with it. But you know, you're left out then. You know, Mills, you're about to say something.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that I do think that Tom is right that each of these is a fairly ephemeral thing. I mean, Facebook has had its, I think it's already had its moment, and before too much longer it will be something else, and whoever invested a lot of money in Facebook will find that their investment's not worth quite as much, but because the trend will have moved somewhere else. But from an educational standpoint, for me, I don't know how many different technologies I've been through now, I think I started in what we might call social networking in its very beginning form with whatever Microsoft's discussion forum system was. I can't even remember what that's called now. And then, you know, on to WebCT and then eventually to blogs. And I now use some social networking things and I let my students IM me. For me, it's all about finding the way that the students are communicating with one another at this particular moment and utilizing that medium to meet them where they are, as Tom said earlier, and be facilitate conversations among them about the work that we're doing in class in that particular medium, and then whatever the next thing is, then we'll move on to there. I do not give them my cell phone number because I don't want them running out my minutes, but beyond that, you know, I think as educators, it really makes our job easier if we try to meet our students where they are.
Mills, did you notice that, and Tom too, did you notice that the way they use their accounts changed? I guess you weren't tracking them before, but knowing that you're online and getting, you know, aggregations of all the student messages on Facebook, I assume that they probably changed their ways a bit, at least during the semester.
I think they ignore me entirely.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I don't think that my presence changes their behavior at all, because I think that behavior is so firmly ingrained. I think they just pretend that I'm not there.
Yeah, me too. And I hope they haven't changed their behavior, because I can't imagine what it was before. if they have, then, well, watch out.
And where do you see this? I mean, going forward, if they do all move over to Verb or these other services, do we need to keep moving on to these things? What if they move on to Twitter or some of these even more caffeinated services, or just to cell phones? Is it possible we completely lose track, or we just have to keep up with whatever the latest and fastest form of communication is?
Go ahead, Tom.
I actually saw, so in the history of this social networking thing, I actually saw the move from MySpace to Facebook as a good thing, because I think
certainly better designed. My God, Facebook is. Look at Facebook. It hurts my eyes.
You mean MySpace?
Yes, MySpace. Facebook, MySpace. I can look at.
Yeah, Facebook has some structure. It has some nice tools. It's like coherent. You know, you can really
right.
It's organized. And so I saw that as a real positive development. If things move on to Twitter, I think we're really in trouble. I mean, I know I tried out Twitter while a bunch of our colleagues were down at South by Southwest, because it was all the rage at South by Southwest. And so I was subscribing to their Twitter messages, to their Twitter streams, and you know, I had to turn it off after about a day, because you were just getting text messages like every 3 minutes with 140 characters of basically nothing, because what can you say in 140 characters?
Right.
If it moves in that direction, I think we're in trouble. But if it continues to move in the Facebook direction, which allows for more structure, I think, you know, maybe we could be okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mills.
But I think we also have to keep in mind that you know, there are a lot of other social networking applications aside from these two big networks of MySpace and Facebook, and I think Flickr is probably one of the biggest of the other ones, and there are all kinds of social networks emerging on Flickr. I just posted a bunch of photographs that I took when I was in Cambodia a couple of weeks ago, pictures I took at the genocide center there, and there's some group that is an emergent NGO group focusing on justice issues around the world, and they want permission to use a bunch of my photographs, and they want me to join their group, and which I'm probably not going to do because I have not enough time as it is, but you know, these kinds of networks are emerging around images, and you know, we've already seen a number of good examples. I've written about some of these in my blog of people using Flickr as a teaching tool, and so it has lots of social networking capability that has a lot more educational value, while at the same time providing the same kind of functionality of connecting people.
Right, right. And I think that that's interesting. I mean, part of it is just being found, and you know, they found your pictures, and you become part of the online conversation, which I think is pretty critical. I suppose, well, I'll definitely have to get a Facebook page, but for the fall, unless it's passé by that point. It seems like from there, I think we also probably have a duty to sort of push on our students to adopt, let's say, if there is a variety of these sites, you know, move them away from Twitter if that's exclusively what they want to use, if they have technological limits, like this 140-character limit, where we can't really have real conversations or... it seems to me like at least Facebook, you can write a pretty long post, let's say on a reading or, you know, what you did at a museum or what you like best. And, you know, I think as long as they're using technologies that allow for that kind of, you know, longer form and more in-depth conversation, then it seems like it's fine with me.
Yep, I would agree. I'm not going to Twitter.
Sounds good. All right. Well, I guess we all pledge not to get on Twitter unless something changes. Or
I guess I got a pledge to get off.
Yes, get off now, Tom.
When I first saw Twitter, it reminded me of Ross Perot's description of NAFTA, the giant sucking sound.
Yeah.
And I could just see it sucking people's time right down the drain.
Absolutely.
Right after this call, it was going to be an intervention in Tom's office. Well, as regular listeners know, we like to end each podcast with a brief discussion of some of the links or resources that we found online, and hopefully we'll find that our audience find these helpful too. Tom, what did you have for this week?
I have something that's not a site, and it's actually not directly related to digital humanities, but I think it's something that people might find useful. I don't know how many people out there are devotees of David Allen's Getting Things Done, but a number of people I know here at Center for History and New Media are, and a lot of people kind of out there in the tech blogging community are. It's essentially an organizational system. It's sort of a business self-help book, which normally I shy away from, but this one particular book, Getting Things Done, is a really helpful way for managing your time and all of the things that you have to do. And I know people working with computers tend to be, go through organizational systems. Sometimes it seems like one a week, and Getting Things Done is something that has really helped me and helped a lot of people I know. So I would point people to the book, but I would also point people to a new product, and unfortunately it's for Mac only, but it's called IGTD, Getting Things Done, and it's a Mac only product, built into the technology is this Getting Things Done system, and it's really been a great thing for me for helping me to organize all the many things I have going
on. So Thomas includes to-do lists and things like that.
Right, it includes to-do lists. It includes sort of project management tools, and it logs all that activity and saves it all. As you check things off, they don't disappear. They're saved in case you have to go back to them. And it's got very good integration with Apple Mail and other email clients.
Really?
So it's really useful thing. I mean, it's not specifically digital humanities, but digital humanities people are working very hard, I know, and so it could be something that helps out.
Yeah, these tools are really, I think, important. I've had a kind of love-hate relationship with the Getting Things Done. I always wanted to implement some system like that, but I somehow never seem to get around to it. So it sounds like this software is really worth a try.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks. That sounds great. Mills, what do you have for this week?
My site this week is scenemaker.net. And scenemaker.net is a fairly new site that allows you to pull any video that's posted online into their system, so from YouTube or Google Video or wherever it might live. It pulls it into their system, and then you can cut it into individual clips, mark up those clips with tags or text, and then save them in your account and point people to your individual bits of it. So we were talking about YouTube, I guess, about a month ago now, and I mentioned the Nuremberg Tribunal video. Well, this morning I tried out SceneMaker and pulled one of those Nuremberg Tribunal videos in, cut it into several pieces that I might use in a lecture where I only want to show one little 30-second clip out of the 4.5 minutes, but I also have it then tagged and have some explanatory text to go with it. It's incredibly simple to use, and I think could really expand the possibilities for educational uses of online video.
Well, it sounds really terrific. I know we've been experimenting with various annotation systems and video clip systems, but this seems like it brings it all together and also has the virtue of being easy to use, which some of these systems don't have. Sounds great. Well, as I promised at the beginning of the podcast in our news roundup, I wanted to point everyone who's interested in the digital humanities to a new site that arose out of the meeting from last week on digital humanities centers. I've set up a wiki, actually, because of Tom's excellent suggestion a few weeks ago about good wiki tools. I've put this on PB Wiki, P as in peanut and B as in butter, wiki, and it's just digital humanities, all one word, .pbwiki.com. And we're going to be slowly building out that site. People who attended the conference, and actually the general public as well, will be building out the site with information about the digital humanities centers, where it's being practiced, tools we use and that we're building ourselves, standards and other technologies that come into play, and all kinds of things like this. So it'll be, I think, a nice institutionally independent place for new people who are new to the topic, and also old hats who want to see what's going on at these various centers, new projects, what people are working on. I think we're also going to have pages for individual biographies so people can add their names to the list. And so again, that's at digitalhumanities.pbwiki.com. If you want to contribute, take a look. Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks, Mills, once again for our fourth podcast.
We've hit
the grand slam. Sure. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks with another Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for you.